Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Today we're going to be reading the experience of a man named Spencer, whose last name is not given in the book that I'm reading. Let me share a quick little story about where I'm getting this from. I was listening to a near-death experience being shared from a talk given at an IONS conference, and the experiencer recommended the book Visions of Glory by John Pontius. Now, I had once read a book by John Pontius that had deeply touched my life as a teenager, and I thought, oh, has he had a near-death experience? And it turns out, well, I don't know whether he did or not, but he did interview someone who did. And Spencer, who he's talking about here, he interviewed Spencer for about 50 hours of interviews in order to get the information in this book. And then the book was written as if from Spencer's mouth, but he tells right up front that this is John Pontius's words taken from the, you know, dozens of hours of interviews that he had with Spencer. So Spencer is telling the story, but in using John Pontius's words, if that makes sense. So, and as a preface, he actually has four different near-death experiences from what I read in the introduction. I have not yet read the book. In fact, at that day that I listened to the IONS conference lecture, on the way home, I stopped at a thrift store to see if there was any near-death experience books. And Visions of Glory was right there on the shelf, looking pristine and ready to buy at a really good price. And I thought, that is just too ridiculous a coincidence. So I bought it. So we'll see where this goes. I have not read this other than to find the place where his near-death experience begins, so that we don't have to go through all the medical background and so forth. I will say that he did have a nearly dying experience as a baby, in that he was a stillborn birth and was brought back. And my understanding is he doesn't have any memories from that initially, or he doesn't remember it during his, during that, you know, he has that experience as a baby, brand newborn, and doesn't remember it again until his life review in later subsequent near-death experiences. And like I said, he has four throughout his life, if you include that first one. Okay, so now he's in his 30s, and he has kidney problems. And he's had to go in for several procedures. He's had kidney stones that he's had to deal with, and internal infections, chronic internal infections, he says. So anyway, he's going in for another one of these. It's kind of a busy time in his life. He's trying to get his doctorate degree and trying to finish that up before any more major medical problems. But, you know, as medical goes, when it's time to have a procedure. So he's having another procedure. Okay, and that's where we're going to pick up on in the book. This is on page 4, Visions of Glory by John Pontius. I was feeling fearful of the procedure, but thought it was necessary, so I submitted as the nurse started the IV. She was young, blonde, and attractive. I assumed she was in her mid-30s. I liked her friendliness, cheerfulness, and confidence. We spoke about the procedure and possible complications. She explained some of the possible symptoms of an allergic reaction to the dye as she carefully injected the dye into my arm. She said, "If you feel flush," and that very second I began to feel flush, she continued, "if you feel your skin itching," as I began to itch severely all over my body, she said, "if you feel pressure in your chest or feel like you can't breathe, just as I felt a horrible crushing feeling in my chest, as if an elephant had sat on me. I tried to say, "I can't breathe," but I couldn't get the words out. I raised my free arm and hand to my neck and quickly drew them across my throat, trying to get the nurse to realize that I was in trouble. I grabbed my throat in what I knew was the universal sign of choking. It was at that moment that the nurse comprehended my cues and realized something was seriously wrong. She ran to the near wall and pushed a large red button. A buzzer went off loudly, and a recorded voice from the clinic's PA began repeating, "Code blue, room 24, code blue, room 24. Having worked in the hospital for many years, I had responded to such a call many times, never anticipating someday I would be the subject of such an announcement. The next thing I knew, my spirit was sinking down through the table. I had my eyes wide open, not wanting to miss any part of this experience, and just felt my spirit sink until I could see the underside of the table. I didn't want to be under the table, and in an instant I found myself standing beside the procedure table, looking at my lifeless body stretched out before me. The large black and white clock on the wall right before me read 9:20 a.m. The nurse tried to find a pulse and couldn't. She swore and shouted back at the control room, "I'm losing him! I'm losing him!" A male technician rushed into the room. Immediately, people assembled to try to revive me. A doctor I had not seen before ran into the room, and for some reason I immediately knew that he was having an affair with the nurse who started the IV. It came as a complete surprise to me that I knew this. I found my mind full of new information that was coming at me more from more from my heart than from my usual senses. I also knew that this nurse was recently divorced. I knew how she valued and feared this relationship with the doctor who was now working beside her to save me. I knew how hard she struggled to be good at her profession and still be a good mom to her two sons at home. I knew she had terrible financial problems. I knew everything about her I knew everything about her, actually every detail of her life, and every decision, fear, hope, and action that had created her life. I could hear her mind screaming in fear. She was praying for help, trying to take control of her fear and remembering her training. She desperately did not want me to die. I looked at the other people in the room and was astonished that I could hear their thoughts and know the details about their lives just as vividly as the nurse. There is a heightened spiritual sensitivity that comes from being dead that I had never anticipated or heard of before. I knew what everyone was thinking. Actually, it was greater than just knowing what they were thinking. I also knew every detail of their lives. I knew if they were good people or bad, if they were honest or corrupt, and I knew every act that had brought them to that state. It wasn't something I felt or could see. It was just knowledge that was in me. What was even more interesting to me was that I felt no judgment of them. I simply knew these things. It was like knowing a rose is red. It isn't something people judge. It's just the way the flower is. What I did feel, which was totally new to me, was a rich compassion for them and their circumstances. Since I knew so much about them, I also knew their pains and their motivation for everything they had done that had taken them to this moment in time. I also felt their fear of losing me. Their actions and reactions were calculated, forcing them to remain calm. Only the doctor working on me felt a sort of detachment that allowed him to act with less emotion. Feeling their fear and the full impact of their lives caused me to experience their pain almost as keenly as they felt it, and I had total compassion for them. I did not feel fear for myself up to then. I was too busy coming to terms with all these new sensations. I felt myself standing a little farther away. I think I had stepped back a little to give them room to work on my body because they were walking or running through the same space where I had been standing. I must be dead, I remember thinking. I had to think this process over a few times before it really sunk in. I am dead. It finally hit me as I saw my body on the table. Me in the new body form, standing above it in complete comfort with no pain. Just moments ago, I was in the greatest pain I had ever felt before, or I ever before felt. And now I was completely free from all pain and the cares of that tabernacle of flesh. They were now gone. It was such a relief that discovering I was dead didn't cause any great distress. I just accepted that I was dead because I was looking at my body there on the table. I was standing there watching all of these people try to revive me. They were shouting commands and demands and injecting me with life-restoring substances. The next awareness I had was that I was able to comprehend many things simultaneously. I didn't need to focus on any one thing because they were all clear to my understanding. I felt like I could understand limitless amounts of knowledge and focus upon an infinite number of matters, giving each my absolute attention. This was amazing to me, and so different from my experience as a struggling graduate student trying to memorize volumes of information. My life rehearsal. At this moment, I began to see a vision of my whole life. Because I had this new ability to comprehend so many things at once, the vision was all-absorbing and important and curious to me, but I still had a full comprehension of each doctor and nurse around me and what was happening to my body. The first thing that I saw was my mother carrying me in her womb. I didn't just see her, I completely comprehended her whole life, her pains and sorrows, every thought she had had, every decision she had made, every emotion she had felt. I realized that in all my life, I actually did not know my mother at all. I had always looked at her from a child's perspective, and I had never been able to excuse her entirely for not wanting me. She had told me the story of how my biological father had left her pregnant, penniless, and homeless. She had never spoken unkindly of the fact that I had been born. However, she had made it clear throughout my life that we children were a great burden to her, and that she was left to do it all alone with no help. I now saw her completely differently. I watched my own conception and all of the emotion of that event. As with all of this, there was no judgment from me or from God. I felt no emotion about it except increased compassion for my mother. I saw that she had two other children, I being the third. I watched her every breath, every decision, every fear and tear she shed. I saw many people, mostly her professional friends, trying to convince her to either abort me or give me up for adoption. They told her I would be a constant reminder of my incompetent father and what he had done to her. I also saw others, her friends and church leaders, even my grandparents, trying to convince her to keep me and raise me. I saw and felt my mother's decision process in concluding to keep me. It was as if she had gone through this process so many times that she could see the outcomes from this choice and how it would impact her and me for the rest of our lives. She felt so alone and rejected. She felt like a failure, and that she simply was not able to raise another child. Yet she was also a nurse who had worked with women in similar settings to her own, and she felt that she could not subject her own child to the adoption process. She decided that sending me off to live with another family would not do anything good for her baby or for herself. She had an extremely difficult time with love, trust, and relationships. She was going through her own depression and sense of loss, so love was not a big part of her decision. She was thinking things like, two wrongs are not going to make a right, and I need to clean up my own mistakes. Her decision was not based upon love. It was based upon rationalization. She kept me out of duty and responsibility. She had not been raised by loving parents. Her father was stern and physically abusive. Her mother was an invalid who was in her bed for the majority of the day. As I noted, she had been disowned by her parents, and she knew how awful that felt to a child. So here she was, choosing to do what was right, not what was convenient. Her depression and loss drove motherly love far from her. I realized also that I had been involved in my mother's life before I was born. I had, in a sense, been a ministering angel to her, watching and protecting her through the hard times leading up to my birth. It was a validating and peaceful insight for me. I wanted to be born to her, even in those trying circumstances, and she had made the difficult decision to keep me. I experienced the love I had for her before I was born, and it has remained with me ever since. It has been a balm of Gilead to my soul, and has allowed me not only forgive her, but to fully understand her as a completely different person, one who really did love me long before she or I had been born. I saw all of the events of her life leading up to her going to the hospital to deliver me. I felt her fear and anger every step of the way. She was not healthy, either physically or emotionally. The dark emotion of those days had sapped her life and robbed my unborn body of the vitality it needed to survive. I watched my mother in labor and was amazed to see many angels attending my birth. Two of the nurses in the delivery room were not mortals, but were angels. They were either translated persons or resurrected because they had bodies. They acted like the other nurses, showing emotion and taking orders. But they were only there to help this woman and her child who was dying at birth. My mother felt so alone. Her main emotion was of abandonment and sadness. She didn't know anything about these angels that were helping her, which seems to be the case in most angelic interventions. We are aware of only little of what the angels do. In her pain of giving birth under these sad circumstances, she didn't realize that all of these spirit people were there, intervening, protecting, and bringing forth life. Even in her despair, divinely commissioned beings were there giving her strength and lovingly helping her so that she and I could have life together. I'm going to stop there in the book. I do want to pick up on this again, probably in tomorrow's episode, because this is beautiful. This is just absolutely astonishing. There's several things that I caught on to that I found very interesting. Some of a technical nature and others of an emotional nature. But among them, Spencer is standing over his body and begins to comprehend the thoughts and feelings of those in the room, particularly the nurse, probably because he'd noticed her at the very beginning and she'd been with him the whole time. And he says, in terms of how this felt and how these impressions of people came, he says, first off, he recognizes that the doctor who came in, who he'd never met before, he knew that that man was having an affair with the nurse who had been putting in the IV. I mean, information that could... First off, if he had never met this doctor, and so therefore didn't know he existed, he couldn't even known the guy existed, let alone that he was in the room, let alone that he was having an affair with this nurse. What a ridiculous piece of evidence, if that was later verified, that they were having an affair. I mean, how much more evidence do you need? But this is an interesting point. As he's catching all these glimpses into these people's lives, he says, I found my mind full of new information that was coming at me more from my heart than from my usual senses. More from my heart than my usual senses. As we picture the idea of recognizing other people's thoughts or some kind of telepathy, we tend, at least I tend, as a mortal being who's watched Star Trek and other shows where there's telepaths, I picture it coming into my mind, it coming into my head, you know, so to speak. And this idea of it coming to me from my heart rather than my usual senses, that may provide a clue for us in trying to hone our spiritual abilities a little bit. Maybe we should be looking for those feelings in the area of our heart and in our emotions, in our chest and core areas instead of in our heads. That's kind of interesting to me. It's interesting to me also that not only does he get to see his birth again, but he got to see his mother's entire experience leading up to it, leading up to his birth, all the suffering that she'd gone through, the fallout or whatever it was that she'd had with his father, and the pressure that she was receiving from friends and family to give up, to abort the baby, to keep the baby, to whatever. And he basically knew the details. He says, speaking again of the doctors, he says, I knew every detail of their lives. And then in this life rehearsal, as he called it, or life review, as is more commonly referred to, he's seeing the same thing. He says, because I had this new ability to comprehend so many things at once, the vision was all-absorbing and important and curious to me, but I still had a full comprehension of each doctor and nurse around me and what was happening to my body. And he goes on and talks about how everything, it was as if, I'm going to find that part real quick. Yes, here it is. And the next awareness I had was that I was able to comprehend many things simultaneously. I didn't need to focus on any one thing because they were all clear to my understanding. I felt like I could understand limitless amounts of knowledge and focus upon an infinite number of matters, giving each my absolute attention. That's incredible. In fact, I have long heard from near-death experiences that in that spirit form, people are able to concentrate on more than one thing at once. For example, they'll be seeing their body and seeing what's going on, and at the exact same time, see what's going on in heaven and be talking to divine beings, and maybe even a third thing going on over here, or they're getting, you know, standing in the light and comprehending, you know, the infinite vastness of the universe or whatever. But this I have never heard before, that it was as if he could focus upon an infinite number of matters, giving each my absolute attention. It's like attention. You know, we've talked about how time, not a factor. Location, not a factor. It sounds like attention, not a factor. Meaning that it could be any number of things that you're giving attention to at any given time. And simply by, from many experiences, we learn that simply by giving attention to something, that you see it more broadly. You see its full context. You could look at a watch, for example, and know the intricacies of how it works and how the cogs and gears shift at just the right, in just the right way, so as to make the time, as it were, pass at the exact rate that it needs to. And this seems to be the case with living things, down to the atomic level, to light, to astronomy, the cosmos. I mean, is that to say that we are instantly given perfect knowledge of everything everywhere? I'm not sure that's the case, but it does seem to be that we can gain full knowledge or complete knowledge of any one thing or any number of one things that we give attention to simply by the seeking, simply by asking, and that can be any number of things, which means, again, we're probably only limited by the questions that we ask, the attention that we choose to give. That seems to be what I'm seeing here. Okay, going on, he talks about his seeing his mother's entire experience around her life. I don't know if it would be fair to say that he saw her entire life review, or if he saw just enough of it to see the full context of why she was where she was when he was born, both emotionally, physically, mentally, and so forth. But it seems clear that he saw and understood her in this experience better than he ever did in his lifetime. In fact, he said he had always seen her as mom, basically, not as a separate, independent human being having her own life experience. And I think that's understandable. I don't think we're expected to see our parents as more than our parents, and our siblings as more than our siblings, and our coworkers as more than... I mean, we're expected to strive for that, no question about it. But I just don't think it's possible in our mortal understanding to fully grasp the full context of their lives and therefore be able to perfectly empathize with them. But I think we should strive for compassion. I think that's part of the message. And I think it's so cool that he says that he was as her guardian angel prior to his birth. He was there ministering. He says, "I realized that I had also been involved in my mother's life before I was born. I had, in a sense, been a ministering angel to her, watching and protecting her through the hard times leading up to my birth." Now, I've heard the term ministering angel used before, especially in Christian circles, and you might equate it to a guardian angel. I think I can't find anything that invalidates that equation, ministering angel being a guardian angel. Essentially, he's being a guardian angel to his mom. And he says that was a validating and peaceful insight to him. He sees that his mother is struggling, lonely, in pain and suffering, and he still wants to be her child. How beautiful is that? And she's having to approach this decision from a place of sheer responsibility, duty, and logic, if you will. It wasn't a decision of love, which would be hard for a child growing up to realize. But for a person in this situation, seeing this full context, he probably saw that that was the only way it was going to work. If she acted in emotion, if she was acting out of love, she probably would have made a different decision, which would be to either adopt him out or to have him aborted. In either way, it was just not in the plan. It was not going to work for him, for his life's plan, for her life's plan. Fascinating, fascinating. And then at his birth, at the doctor's, when he's being delivered, he says, "I watched my mother in labor and was amazed to see many angels attending my birth. Okay, that is no surprise. Spirits surrounding, I'm sure, they're helping and probably encouraging him as well as her and so forth. I understand that, but check this out. Two of the nurses in the delivery room were not mortals, but were angels. They were either translated persons or resurrected because they had bodies. Now, to any who are not familiar with the Christian term translated persons, it does come out different to different denominations, but it appears from this context that what it's saying is that these were either persons who had been resurrected, therefore they had physical bodies, or they were persons who had not died and had been, using that term, translated. In many religions, translated is, you know, for example, when Elijah was taken up into heaven without tasting death, he was translated. And then on the Mount of Transfiguration, when Christ is you know, there before with Moses and Elijah and so forth, both of whom in many accounts are said to have been translated. Basically, they never died. They were just put in a state that made it so they could not die, and therefore they were physical beings. That's where that term seems to be. That seems to be what it's applying to, because he says, because they had bodies. They acted like the, I'm reading here, they acted like the other nurses, showing emotion and taking orders, but they were only there to help this woman and her child who was dying at birth. So angels are not always just spirits. This is so cool. I have not come across this very often in near-death experiences, but this is a clear indication of it, that some of the people that we in mortality see as other mortal beings, physical persons in hospital attire, giving orders, they probably have a name badge, and they probably have even been working at that hospital for a few weeks or whatever. I don't know how that works, but you know, I'm kind of picturing like touched by an angel kind of a situation where they're there and they're part of the whole thing, and but they're, you know, giving orders, taking orders, and they're there, but they're angels. I think that's so cool. I just think that's fascinating. So I'm going to go ahead and end there as far as the story is concerned. But I would like to pick up on this story. We'll have to skip around some because it goes on in much greater detail about the angelic nurses, which I'd love to, you know, read more about. But again, I do encourage you to get this book, and then we'll jump into further to see what else happens in this near-death experience beyond his standing by his body and having his life review. Again, this is Visions of Glory, as told to John Pontius, and it's subtitled One Man's Astonishing Account of the Last Days, which kind of makes me think that he's probably going to see things in the future and so forth. And we've not talked a lot about that in near-death experiences for a couple of reasons. It's not that I've been avoiding it. I do want to share those things as well, but mostly because they're not that common. I guess they're fairly common, but in terms of showing future events, there are several disclaimers that near-death experiencers actually give, and that, for example, you'll often hear, as they say, you know, I saw this happen on the earth, you know, and this was, you know, somewhere around the year, I don't know, 2050 or whatever, you know, and then they'll talk about wars or different things going on. But then they'll say, but the angels there with me, or the spirits with me, or the voice or whatever, told me that these are possible outcomes, that if we don't change our ways, this is what it will be. And then they'll be shown another future that will say, but if we do change our ways, this will be the outcome. And then we'll be given another a vision that says, and if we really shape up, basically, if we really give these warnings the heed that they deserve, that this is what potentially could happen. And they'll see this beautiful golden age of humanity. And they'll be given multiple visions of the same time period and totally different events happening. And since not everybody receives those multiple visions, people often come back with the impression that this is what's going to happen, get ready. When the message may have been intended, this is what may happen if this, this, and this are chosen by society. And if society chooses to do this, this, and this, then this will happen. And I say society chooses because, you know, we talk about a collective consciousness, meaning the individual agency of an entire group of people. I would call that a collective consciousness. If the entire group of people, or at least the majority, have this idea that we need to transcend war, we need to transcend hatred, we need to transcend all these problems that we have and become more, then we can, you know, create a golden age of humanity. There's no reason we can't. God has given us that promise. And that's what these angels are saying anyway, these angels that often show these visions of the future. And so we probably won't get into all that, but I mean, this is an entire book. I mean, it's a 260 something page book, and looks like it's a really fascinating account, and I'd like to read more of it again, like I said, tomorrow. But we won't be able to get into all of it. So look up the book. I want to reiterate our phone number, 970-NDE-CAST. That is, let me just see here, I have to look it up. And I do want to emphasize also that, or I do want to say also, that if you, you know, don't want to, or if you do want to call, but you're worried about the long distance number, which, you know, if you're working off a landline or something like I generally do, so, you know, don't feel like you're out of date. There's another option that you can do. If you just use your smartphone or your computer or something that can record your voice and share your full experience on there and then email that experience to me, you can email that file to neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. So if you want to send that that audio to me to put on the podcast and not have to worry about phone technicalities or long distance numbers, or if you just want a better quality, whatever, then go ahead and send it that way. Now, I will warn you about that. The bigger or longer the file is, the more challenge you're going to have in trying to send it. For example, if you have a 60 megabyte file, which would be a high quality MP3 of more than 10 or 15 minutes or whatever, then it may be a little bit challenging to send. However, you can get that to me. You know, you can upload it to archive.org. That will, you know, just so you know, put it in the public domain and so forth. But then you can send me a link. Or if you have a blog that you can upload it to and then send me a link. Whatever you want to do to get audio to me, I'll take it. That's great. You know, anywhere, anything that you can do that will provide a URL with an .mp3 at the end, I can easily download that, put it on the podcast. I'm pretty savvy with figuring out how to get sound onto into a usable format for myself to put on the podcast. So any way you want to get audio to me, that's the email address. The phone number, you could also text to it, text a link or whatever. But if you just want to, you know, speak in your smartphone, use something like Easy Voice Recorder app, which is the one I use. It records in WAV file, not too big of files, and you could probably get about an hour of talking on that and have it be under 10 or 15 megabytes, which should send to the neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. So, any way that you can get that question, comment, or experience to me, I would love to include it in the podcast. So again, I think the message of all these near-death experiences seems clear. It's love. It's to show greater compassion and love to one another. And there's many, many ways that that can be done, and that's going to be different for every person. And that's good, and that's beautiful. But show that love. Find ways to show love, because that seems to be the essential factor in everyone's life that they will come up to see in their life review and see what their life really was about. When it comes down to it, they all seem to be saying the same thing. It's all about love. There are other things too, purposes to life and missions and so forth, but ultimately it just comes down to love. So with that, thank you again, all of you, so much for listening.